Hello and welcome to another edition of Inquisitive Minds on Brock Radio, CFBU-FM. My name is Mike Saunders, and each week at this time we explore some of the fascinating research being done by Brock University faculty and students, as well as address relevant issues that could impact the Brock community. On today's show, we talk to a Brock professor doing extensive research into spinal cord injuries. We have an inspirational story from a Brock master's student doing important research into how recreation and leisure pursuits can help people with mental illness live full and engaged lives. And what's up with the monarch butterfly? A Brock sustainability scientist looks at what might be causing a decline in the migratory species population in North America. Inspiring radio for both body and soul, Inquisitive Minds is on the air. Spinal cord injury is a life-altering event most of us luckily will never have to endure. But for those who do, much research is being done into both the consequences of the injury itself and the health complications that can come from SCI. While Rick Hansen's pioneering work in publicizing the barriers faced by those who suffer spinal cord injuries is now very well known, it's almost hard to believe before 2004, very little was known about spinal cord injuries in Canada. A lab at Brock University is hoping to change at least part of that, and our first guest works in that lab. Associate Professor of Kinesiology in Applied Health Sciences at Brock, David Deiter. I asked why, until recently, very little was known about spinal cord injuries in Canada.
There's probably several reasons. I think that only until recently has it really become appreciated that spinal cord injury goes far beyond just the paralysis that's involved. So there is a wide array of other health complications that follow spinal cord injury. We're getting more and more aware of those complications and also more aware on how to prevent or reverse them. So maybe that's why spinal cord injury has been a bit more of a public issue. And also, of course, all the work that Rick Hansen has done. And it's ongoing. It's not just his tour that he did a while back, but the Rick Hansen Foundation is very vocal and very good at putting spinal cord injury into public conversation. So I think it's getting more and more of a public issue lately.
Yeah, I was going to talk about Rick Hansen because his Man in Motion tour, I mean, we're going back almost 30 years now when that happened. And I vividly remember when he came through downtown St. Catharines back then. But that's so many years ago. And there seems to be a bit of a disconnect between then and what we're learning now. And I find that really interesting given the amount he was able to publicize the situation back then, that it still took such a long period of time before we had a better understanding of what was going on here.
It's an excellent foundation. They're certainly working extremely hard every day. It's an extremely complicated issue, and it's such a broad issue. I mean, everything from the physical challenges of trying to heal the actual injury itself all the way to certain psychosocial issues that people are dealing with after injury. So it's such a broad condition to try to approach from a research standpoint and from just a service standpoint that it's hard to move any one direction extremely quickly.
So is spinal cord injury an all-encompassing title for a number of injuries?
Well, no, I wouldn't say that. Spinal cord injury, yes, you're talking about one distinct area of the spinal cord that has been damaged. It's just that the spinal cord is really in charge of the entire body, basically. Depending on how high your injury is, not only are your arms and legs affected, but all of your internal organs can be affected. So you're talking about one injury, but with a very wide array of consequences after that.
Now, I read the highest incidence of injury to individuals is in the age range of 20 to 29.
Yeah.
In a way, that's not surprising because you tend to take more risks during those years until theoretically we settle down and gain some sense, as some of us do, and those who are over 70. And I can understand that as well, because you're getting older and you're more susceptible to injury. So those are the two time frames that are the most susceptible.
Yeah, younger adults, you said the age is between 20 and 29. It's also about twice as prevalent in men as women at that age. And the idea is that young men are risk takers and getting injured from accidents that way. And car accidents and falls are, I think, the top two in that category. But more and more older adults as well, like you said, more seniors are getting injured. And that's not really because of risk-taking behavior as much as it is falls that are happening. So it's nowhere near as common in those older adults, but it is a growing population for spinal cord injury.
So in other words, you and I are basically in the sweet spot. We're in between.
Sure, yeah, we're in between, although it can happen to anyone, obviously, in a blink of an eye. But yeah, it seems to be bimodal in terms of the most common age to get injured.
Yeah, the scary aspect of it is, as you say, it can happen in a blink of an eye.
Yeah.
You're skiing one moment, the next moment you've got a spinal cord injury. Is it irreversible?
Irreversible. It depends on what aspect of spinal cord injury you're talking about. Correct. There is no cure for paralysis. When people get injured, they do make a small amount of physical recovery right after their injury, where certain functions do come back. It isn't a full recovery. So in one way, yes, it's irreversible in that sense. But there are enormous strides that can be made. I mean, you also have to consider the psychosocial aspect of injury as well. And it's just as devastating or more devastating socially and psychologically. And in those cases, people do make what I would consider, yes, a full recovery. Obviously, people have an extremely rough time after their injury, and some people really never make it back emotionally from that. But some people make a complete turnaround and lead wonderful, happy, full lives. So in one sense, it's irreversible. In another sense, I think that there's a lot of hope for people with spinal cord injury once they know that they can certainly go on and lead a happy, fulfilling life.
I didn't realize there would be secondary health complications from SCI other than perhaps muscular deterioration, which would be obvious. But what secondary health complications are we looking at?
Well, there's many. People with spinal cord injury are at a higher risk of cardiovascular disease or at a higher risk of type 2 diabetes. Problems like that are more due to the immobility that accompanies spinal cord injury. So for example, you're a lot less active. There's a lot less opportunity for exercise and activity. So they become susceptible to those diseases of inactivity like heart disease and type 2 diabetes. But there are also a lot of other health consequences that aren't necessarily due to inactivity. So people suffer from bladder dysfunction, bowel dysfunction, sexual dysfunction. The skin tends to break down quite a bit easier. So there's a high susceptibility to pressure sores. There's many complications.
Yeah, when we're talking about pressure sores, what are we specifically talking about here?
A pressure sore can be very mild, what we call a stage one, and progress all the way up to what could be a life-threatening breakdown of the skin, which can penetrate all the way into the muscle and the bone. So it depends how far along that pressure sore has progressed. But it's basically if you're in one position for a long time, for example, if you're seated for a long time and pressure builds up in a certain area, that area gets a chronic lack of blood flow and tissues begin to die in that area. So certainly people are very aware of this and are trying to prevent it all the time. And there's research going on every day on how to prevent these or reverse them once they happen. But it is a very common consequence.
Now, what about the spinal cord itself? When the initial injury happens, does the spinal cord itself deteriorate over time after the injury? And if so, why would that be?
That's an excellent question. Immediately after injury, you end up with the primary area of damage. In the next hours, days, months, that area of the spinal cord that has been injured, the injury actually expands and grows. And we call that secondary tissue damage. So you've got the primary, which happens immediately at the time of the injury. And then unfortunately, that area of damage expands and grows in the cord. And the cord gets more and more injured for a certain amount of time. Why does that happen? There's several reasons why that happens. One is that there is an inflammatory response. So like any injury in your body, it causes an inflammatory response. And the inflammatory cells in this case are certainly doing some good, but unfortunately they also do some harm and the injury gets worse and worse. Not indefinitely, but for a certain amount of time in any individual. There is a large amount of research that is dedicated to preventing that expansion of the secondary injury because one mechanism is that inflammatory response or certain anti-inflammatory strategies which are directed at reducing that amount of expansion of the injury.
As far as the secondary tissue damage, is there any way we can minimize or perhaps at some point even prevent that secondary tissue damage?
There are trials that are going on right now for different strategies aimed at that. There's been a lot of work, of course, in animal research. And from that animal research, there's one or two different drugs or strategies that are right now in clinical trials in Canada as well.
So let's talk about your lab,
sure,
which you've been busily working on and growing up in Brock. What does the lab do and what's some of the work you're working on?
I have a few different interests in spinal cord injury. One, as we already mentioned, is the cardiovascular consequences of spinal cord injury. So I study what happens to the cardiovascular system after injury. I'm I'm also quite interested in immune status after spinal cord injury. So we did mention that people have skin breakdown and bladder issues and there's respiratory problems. So people with spinal cord injury are prone to chronic infections. And because of these infections, their immune state is altered. Because of living with chronic or recurring infections, they get an elevated amount of inflammatory cells in their body over time. And that chronic state of inflammation may cause other consequences as well. So I'm studying the effects of spinal cord injury on the cardiovascular system, and then separately studying the effects of spinal cord injury on immune function and how those alterations in immune function can affect all sorts of things like neural function or even depression cognition.
So would exercise be one way of alleviating these problems or solving the problem?
Yeah, certainly exercise is extremely important after spinal cord injury. It's not a cure-all, but it can help to prevent or partially reverse a lot of the problems that we've been talking about, such as cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes. It possibly has an effect on this chronic inflammation that we're talking about. And also, equally importantly, certainly it has an effect on mood, psychological adjustment to the injury, social integration, all those things as well. So it's not just physical benefits, the exercise. It's also psychological, emotional benefits, the exercise. So because exercise is quite helpful for a lot of these complications, I also have a wheelchair accessible exercise facility that's been slowly growing over time or now finished. So we currently offer a very specialized exercise to people in the Niagara region with spinal cord injury free of charge.
Yeah, the psychological aspects of the injury could be devastating when you realize what you're up against, but it's not the end of the world. And that might be your first inclination to think that once you've suffered a spinal cord injury. So you're addressing that issue as well as the physical.
Yeah, we definitely think that when people come and exercise in our facility, obviously the equipment is geared towards physical benefits, but a wonderful bonus to all this exercise that people are doing is that they're out in the world, they're meeting new people. Some of the people they're meeting also have a spinal cord injury, so, you know, other exercisers in the lab, but they also really make very strong friendships with the student volunteers that are helping out with the exercise. And as a grad student, that's what I spent a lot of my time doing as well. I was one of those student volunteers. That was a long time ago, and I still have some very, very strong friendships from that time as well. So the equipment is geared towards helping, you know, obviously, physical benefits, but the psychological, emotional benefits that the people are making with injuries and their family members as well that sometimes come, I think far outweigh the physical benefits that they make, which can also be substantial. Yeah.
Yeah, obviously, if they're able to get out of the four walls that they're in and they're able to interact with other people who share their concerns and problems that they're facing, that's half the battle. That's helping you right then and
yeah,
there.
Maybe more than half the battle. And also, you know, there's a fantastic service, a peer support service that Spinal Cord Injury Ontario offers. And I would really recommend anyone who's listening, who's struggling with this, or a family member, peer support is such a crucial component of recovery after spinal cord injury. And there are people out there that can help. It's a very well-structured program. Again, it's the peer support program that's offered by Spinal Cord Injury Ontario. And it's where newly injured people get matched up or paired with someone with a spinal cord injury who's had their injury for quite a while, and they know what the person's going through. They can offer insights and solutions and just emotional support. And I think that and a very supportive set of family and friends can really make the difference for people when they're going through this, especially at the early stages.
So your lab is serving everyone in the region, not just specifically the work you're doing at Brock University.
Yeah, I obviously do research in the area of spinal cord injury, but the people that are exercising my lab, some of them are involved in research projects, but not everybody. You can certainly get involved and never volunteer for research. It's just an open community-based exercise program for people with spinal cord injury. It's free of charge, which we're very proud of, and we can do that. We can offer free exercise because all of the students that are helping out, so people do get one-on-one assistance with their exercise program, but that's all done by student volunteers who are just doing it out of the goodness of their heart, and so we can keep our costs extremely low. So we can offer this free exercise, and it's, like I said, open to anyone in the Niagara region with a spinal cord injury.
And those students who are volunteering are gaining valuable information and insight into the situation.
Absolutely. They love it. They love the experience. They love learning about it. They love meeting the people. And like I said, that's how I spend most of my time as a grad student, so I can speak to how life-changing it is to get involved in a program like that.
And the important news that we have to take out of this is if you have a spinal cord injury, doesn't necessarily mean the rest of your life is going to be spent in a wheelchair.
No, it doesn't necessarily mean that. Certainly, there's a lot of people that do use a wheelchair for their primary means of mobility, but spinal cord injury is a very broad condition, and not everyone relies on a wheelchair. I don't want to overstate what we do. Certainly, people make physical benefits, and certainly sometimes we can help people physically to improve their situation, but we don't make such enormous turnarounds where someone would arrive in a wheelchair and then throw it away after a few months. It's more about improving people's health, improving their function.
It gives people some hope that at least their situation can be improved.
Absolutely can be improved, no question, yeah. And I mean, even things can be improved upon that maybe the public, like we said, wouldn't even be aware of that's an issue. So not having someone go from using a wheelchair to walking, but for example, if someone can gain the strength to transfer much more easily from their chair to their car, the amount of independence that people can get from those small improvements are enormous. So we're making more benefits like that, health improvements, functional improvements. And sometimes, yes, sometimes people do make improvements in terms of their walking function. And certainly we do get that, but more for people that already have a little bit of walking function to begin with.
David, thank you very much for coming in today. It was fascinating information.
Thank you very much. I was happy to talk about it.
That was Brock, Associate Professor of Kinesiology and Applied Health Sciences, David Deiter, on his research into secondary health complications that accompany spinal cord injury. If you want more information on programs offered by the Brock Niagara Center for Health and Well-Being, call them at 905-688-5550, extension 5585. That's 905-688-5550, extension 5585. When it comes to dealing with mental illness, we often talk a good game, but that's about it. Not enough action takes place to address the problems associated with those suffering from forms of mental illness. One person out to change that perception is Lauren Torek, a master's student in applied health sciences who is studying how recreation and leisure pursuits help people with mental illness live full and engaged lives. For her efforts, Lauren was awarded a 2013-2014 Ontario Graduate Scholarship to support her research on mental health issues. Lauren's research is driven by her own experiences living with major depressive disorder. Lauren Torek visited our studios earlier this week to talk about her own experiences with mental health issues and what she's trying to do to help others suffering as well. Her story, quite simply, will inspire you. And I asked her first about her own battle and how she overcame her mental health issues.
I was between 20 and 21 years of age, and I had just sort of lost my drive to continue going to school. There was just a lack of vibrancy in my life, and I don't think it was really a conscious awareness at that point. There was about 6 months where I started to have a number of suicidal thoughts, and they seemed to become more frequent and more consumptive of my daily thought process. And I had actually chosen a day and I had a plan and I knew what I was going to do. And it was my dog that saved me. So instead of following through with my plan, I had a puppy that was a Maltese who's now 10. Her name is Abby, and she was at the end of my bed, and there was something about the way she looked at me that I knew I was needed. And so instead of executing my plan, I picked up the phone and I called my mom. And that was the first day of the rest of my life.
Best call you ever made.
Absolutely.
When in doubt, you call someone who matters in your life.
Yeah. And I think the scariest part about experiencing a mental illness is the fear of judgment, the fear of what people will think of you. I was always an athlete. I was always popular. I never appeared on the outside the way I felt on the inside. And as a result of that discrepancy, I felt like I walked out of the house every day wearing a mask. And having the courage to sort of share the discrepancy with other people was the absolute scariest part. I was fortunate enough to have a family around me that contracted with a psychiatrist and our family doctor to support me in our home. I didn't feel that going and being admitted in hospital was best for me. I think that would have been probably counter-therapeutic for my ability to sort of tell the truth. I was so ashamed of what I was experiencing, and there was so much vulnerability within me that I needed my family to be there with me. And interestingly, as I learn more about the experience of mental illness and I talk to other people in the community, I realize how fortuitous that was.
Was your mother surprised when you made that call? Did she have any inkling prior to that phone call that you were in crisis?
That's a funny question, because I feel like I did such a great job of covering it up. Both of my parents were probably shocked, but I think there was an element of defeat that they felt. They had done something wrong in my life that they, you know, they should have known.
They let you down.
Yes, or they let down their responsibility that they had. And I think my parents in particular feel a heightened responsibility to care for my sister and I. They actually adopted the two of us after trying to have kids for 10 years. And we talk a lot about in our family the fact that every parent loves their child. No matter what their child does in the world, there's this love that exists between a parent and their child that is indisputable. And it really is unconditional. My parents always felt they were the luckiest parents in the world, not because they had perfect kids, but because they got to have kids. And so I think finding out that one of their children had gotten to the point where they were so internally destructed, they had planned to take their own life, I think there was an element of humility.
What was your mother's response when you told her? What did she advise you to do?
She very quickly said, "I will be home in 15 minutes." And in the process, called the family doctor. We went to see the family doctor. There had been a lot, you know, when we look back at the history of my experience from about 13 onward, there had been a lot of times where I had said, as a young teenager, slamming doors, "I'm going to kill myself," and just being a dramatic young girl. And so I'm not even totally convinced that either of my parents had full confidence that I would have been able to follow through with the plan I had. And in fact, I would say it's likely that I probably never truly planned to, because the mere fact that a look from a dog could inspire enough courage to make a call showed me that there was still hope in my life. I just truly didn't know where to find it.
You needed a trigger, and the dog provided that.
Absolutely. And it's funny because I'm very fortunate to still have Abby today, and not a day goes by that I don't thank her for giving me my voice back. In my writing, within journaling components of my research, I talk a lot about the bond that I have with my dogs. And with this disorder, it's very cyclical. So there will be times where I'm feeling really great. And then there's times where getting out of bed seems like it's one hell of a task. And so I set myself up for success every day. I know that no matter where I'm at in my life or what I feel that moment when I wake up, I know they will inspire a sense of altruism within me. They will make me get up no matter what. So I actually have their crate beside the bed about 4 feet away. And when I wake up in the morning, a little siren goes off and someone starts making noise. And sure enough, that's enough to remind me, oh yeah, they need me. And so I get up. Now, coincidentally, we also have two Newfoundland dogs. Our male is about 165 pounds and at head level of our king size bed. So once he realizes that we're awake, it's unlikely that your face isn't going to get soaked.
And there's no chance you're ever going to be able to get back to sleep.
Exactly.
He's not going to allow that.
No, although he is one lazy dog. For some reason, the dog that sleeps all day has 15 minutes of energy when he first wakes up, enough to remind mom that it's time to get up.
You told me before the interview you have 10 pets.
Yes.
So 6 dogs and 4 cats.
We do.
Okay. Recently on the show, I talked with Christine Tardif-Williams about a study she's conducting in conjunction with the dog therapy program, the gist of which is to research the role animals play in promoting basic social and emotional competencies in children. You've got several therapeutic dogs.
Mm-hmm.
So they've helped you with your recovery. The mere fact that they're there when you get up in the morning mm-hmm. is the start of your day and the reason that you're getting up in the morning, one of the big reasons. How else have they helped you?
I think dogs instill an element of routine within your life. Dogs and cats, pets in general, but I would say as much as our cats instill routine, they're pretty lazy and self-sufficient, whereas dogs, they rely on you. It's like having a 2-year-old around the house at all times. And so I think they support me both emotionally and physically. They bring that element of physical activity into my life every day. It would be very hard to function in a household of 6 without a good walk. So they're part of my daily routine to make sure that I'm giving to them what they give back to me. And so they support the physical side, the emotional side. And for me, because I do a lot of work with them, I do quite a bit of obedience with them. I like to do canine sports in general. They also provide a unique cognitive outlet because I have to sort of try to think the way they think and learn the way they learn. And so they give you patience and they make you think about the world in a new way.
I can only imagine what walking regimen must be like in your household. I mean, the average person takes their dog out for a walk in the the evening, first thing in the morning, you've got six of them.
Yes.
Do you have to coordinate a schedule for this, or do you go out with all of them?
We all go out at once. Our biggest dog's about 165, and our smallest is just under 3. So we have quite a divide in our house. And I'm sure you can imagine 2 Newfoundland dogs on one side and 4 small dogs under 6 pounds on the other usually gets a lot of attention. On top of that, our male Newfoundland dog is one of the most rare colors in the world, only recognized by the American Kennel Club, and it's called Beige. It looks kind of like a sandy brown, and he gets a lot of attention when we're just out on our own because no one can ever figure out what he is. And then, of course, when we explain to them he's a Newfoundland dog, it turns into, I've never seen this color. We can usually predict how the conversation's gonna go, but it's all about education and patience, so we're okay talking about our pets. But as far as our regiment goes, it's all 6 at once. And the funniest thing is, I would say at least once a week, someone asks me for my business card for my dog walking service. And I usually just have gotten to the point where I say, oh, you know what? I forgot them at home. Because when I tell people they're all mine, they usually go, what? And they're just shocked. They all live in the same house with the same crazy human.
You must be quite the show going around the neighborhood.
We are a spectacle, but we do try to keep it pretty quiet. As far as our dogs aren't allowed to bark, we are very respectful of the community, and we, me in particular, I don't expect everyone to love my dogs. In fact, I don't expect anyone to like my dogs, and I think it's beneficial if they do, and of course I love it when people want to interact with them because I know it makes them feel good. But I realize that the sheer number of animals that we have is offensive to some people, so I try to be pretty strategic. I don't want to be an impediment on anyone else's enjoyment in daily living. So we are fortunate that next door to our house, our neighbors on either side, dog lovers on one side, they're an elderly couple that don't have any dogs, and dog lovers on the other side who actually have a couple of dogs, including one that's over 200 pounds. So they really get the world that we live in, and that is very helpful.
That makes your life that much easier.
Yes.
I would think if either side decides at some point to move away, you somehow find a way to prevent that from happening.
Yes. No
You'll
kidding.
Be glad you did.
No kidding.
Let's talk about your research, which has to do with how recreation and leisure pursuits help people with mental illness live full and engaged lives. Now, you're talking about being out there, being engaged, like you yourself. You're active, you're out there, you're doing things. Leisure time means different things to different people. But what you're looking at is making constructive use of that leisure time.
Yes. And for me, I try not to put parameters on exactly what leisure is for a particular individual because it's such an intimate and subjective experience that what drives boredom for me might be extremely stimulating for someone else. So I work really hard to talk to people in terms of what do you do in your free time that is meaningful and how is that carried through in your ability to support yourself on an ongoing basis? What's the impact of that? How does it feel when you engage in that activity? And I really approach it with a non-judgmental lens because I want to find out what is it about the leisure experience and what is it about the activity that helps people feel good about themselves? Because I think there's a lot of devaluing of free time engagements in general. You know, you go back to the olden days, idle hands are the devil's work sort of idea. And so people think working all the time is admirable and courageous. And I would argue that having the courage to engage in leisure that's personally meaningful, to give something back to yourself, is much more courageous than being an ostrich and sticking your head in the sand and working all the time. I think that leisure is literally the only place in our lives that we can truly find new elements of who we are. We discover things about ourselves through enjoyable activities that we can't necessarily explore in a professional setting. We can take on new personalities. You think about, although I'm not a video gamer, you think about someone who can create an avatar and play a video game that, yes, is a sedentary engagement, but there's something in that process where they're able to be someone other than themselves, and there's something really powerful about that. So I think people are afraid of the idea of someone wanting to know about their free time activities because it's like someone coming into your bedroom and going through your underwear drawer. It's what is most intimate and what a lot of people hide.
So if you're treading on that personal space of theirs, they may feel threatened.
Yes. So I think a big part in the research is making sure that as I talk to people about what they do in their free time, really being open-minded and non-judgmental and letting them know that there is no right or wrong answer. It's about how you support yourself. I choose dogs. In some regards, you could say that it was a coincidence that I attribute my recovery to a simple look from a dog. I don't feel it was a coincidence. I feel that it was something personally meaningful to me that connected to me at a time where I needed it, and it gave me a purpose greater than myself. And I think it doesn't really matter what you do. I have no desire to judge what people do to support their recovery. What I challenge is people who are afraid to support their own recovery and afraid to engage in something that is meaningful and discover a new side of their life or find a way to give their life new meaning.
Why do you think the benefits of leisure continue to be overlooked and underappreciated as far as therapy is concerned?
I think it's terrific that you just asked me that question because, funny enough, this is National TR Month. So I am a therapeutic recreation specialist, and rec therapy in general is a profession that we are working really hard to try and put ourselves on the map and make people understand what it's all about. There's a number of political issues associated around rec therapy, one being that although we are a recognized allied health profession within the healthcare arena, we're not a regulated health profession the way other professions such as occupational therapy or physiotherapy are. So without that self-regulating body, there is some disregard for our ability to practice, for the effectiveness of our practice, and there's also some pay issues. We can't mandate a fee service without a college. We are working very hard. A number of the professors at Brock University, as well as at the University of Waterloo, are sitting on different boards and trying to create that college for rec therapy so that we can better validate the profession. And I think through validating that profession, we'll be able to validate the role of leisure and its importance, because once the profession is a standardized minimum requirement in order to practice in all types of different facilities, long-term care facilities, you've got all of the medical health arena, you've got rehabilitation. Once we can standardize practice and create a minimum educational requirement, we can have practitioners that are really following a certain protocol and making sure that they are taking the time to provide elements of leisure education. Because without that educational piece of making people understand why rec therapists do what they do, both professionally and personally, it's really hard for people to understand how impactful recreation and leisure engagements can be on your ability to overcome adversity or just live a more meaningful life.
Your thesis is going to include in-depth interviews with individuals who've been diagnosed with a mental illness, mm-hmm. but who are socially connected, satisfied with their lives, demonstrating success in education, vocational pursuits. This is according to the profile on you from the Evidence Exchange Network that I read. That's essentially you. Mm-hmm. That is you in a nutshell. Mm-hmm. So you're looking for the positive in these individuals, accentuating the positive, if you will, and building on that.
Yes. Part of the profile, the people that I am interviewing, it does very much mirror my life and sort of my recovery process over the past 10 years. And that is by design. I'm doing a heuristic methodology, which means I actually am part of my data. So my story, my whole narrative has become part of this thesis because I need to take ownership of not only the story that I have, but the influence that my story has on my overall view of recreation and leisure and the benefits that it has. So I don't believe any research exists without bias, but in particular, the people that I'm looking at, I'm hoping that they can tell me things about themselves that are different than my experience so that I can sort of learn more. I'm merely one person, and the people that I look at, I know that they will have a different lens and they'll be able to show me things that I maybe didn't think about in my own life and sort of inspire new thought in that regard.
I want to talk about the Niagara Falls by-election that's coming up this week. There was an interesting comment made, I read online, after the last all candidates debate. A news person noted the fact that when asked about dealing with mental illness, not a single candidate had a relevant response. They all essentially danced around the issue, but nobody had any plan to address the situation, and that was worrisome. Are we dropping the ball on this? We talk a good game. Yes, we've got to do something. We have to help these people. But that's all we do. We drop the ball when it comes to actually putting that into practice.
Absolutely. We know that 1 in 5 Canadians will experience mental illness. And we also know that the remaining 4 will have a friend, family member, or colleague who will. That is a quote right out of the beginning of my thesis. And it's a quote that I embed in pretty much everything I do. This is an epidemic. When you actually break down the numbers, 2/3 of the population in Canada who experience a mental illness in their lifetime will not receive services. A product of that likely is stigma, lack of awareness, family supports, and the community's ability to provide avenues or outlets for people to safely begin the conversation. I can say from personal experience, it doesn't matter how often I tell my story, every single time I walk into a room with a new set of ears, it is terrifying. When I read the article that was released on the university website, the very first thing I said to my supervisor when she called me with great excitement, I said, I feel like I want to go and hide in a closet. And we kind of had a laugh because I write about self-stigma being more powerful than community stigma, because self-stigma is perpetuated by the views in the community, but then it's internalized and it turns into this vicious cycle. And it doesn't matter how much I write about it, I'm still guilty of it. I still felt shame and embarrassment. And I felt like the academic world was going to think I was less of a researcher or wasn't deserving of the opportunity to do a PhD and not ever deserving of any kind of faculty position that I'm working really hard to get to. So I think we really, really do drop the ball within the greater Niagara community in so many aspects. And the problem is we don't know how to pick it back up again. And it's such an issue. There's so many ways that we could support people in a way that was meaningful for them. And yet there aren't any ears to listen to the ideas of what we have. I think there is a ton of amazing research happening at the university, in particular on mental health. It is such a hot topic right now, and yet there's a disconnect between the community and the university for so many reasons. One being that there's this idea that researchers aren't accessible within the greater community, that these people have PhDs and they've spent their whole lives doing research and I'm not worthy of hearing what they have to say, or better yet, they think they're better than me. Transitioning from an undergraduate degree into the graduate world was a challenging transition for me, because as you become a graduate student and you work your way through and you discover the accolades or come across these accolades, like an Ontario Graduate Scholarship or an article in the Brock News or this wonderful write-up provided by Bonnie for me on the Exchange Network, you come across these different opportunities and you feel like an imposter. I feel like I don't belong. And yet you continuously get welcomed by your faculty members and they're proud of you and they see things in you that you don't really see in yourself. And the biggest challenge for me is to try and see my supervisor as a human being, try and see my department chair as a human being, realize that it doesn't matter what we do professionally, it's how we behave, it's how open we are to having conversations with people. And I feel like that might be a starting point in the community, is reaching out and talking to someone like me, a nobody at the university, who can have a conversation comfortably about what my ideas are and brainstorm. You know, why don't we have a giant think tank in the community of researchers and people who actually experience mental illness? I feel like if you are someone that's had a mental illness, you are the person that should be telling us how to make it better. How can we help you? It shouldn't be about us providing solutions for them. It should be people like me and people who are worse off than me giving solutions that are meaningful to them back to the people who can make them happen.
You've lived it. Who better to consult as to how to solve the problem than those who have survived it?
Yep.
And know the difficult road to recovery that these people face.
Yeah.
You're going to be working on your doctoral studies at Brock.
Yes.
So you're not going anywhere for a while. What do you think you're going to be doing, say, in 10 years from now? What do you see yourself doing?
Oh my goodness, what do I see myself doing? Well, by then I should probably have about 47 dogs. No, I'm very committed to reducing the number of dogs that I have. 6 will be my max as of right now. I have a number of short-term and long-term goals. Of course, 10 years from now, God help me if I haven't finished a PhD, because that will be, well, about 20 years in school altogether when all is said and done. So I would like to have a faculty position. My ideal would be at Brock University, the university that supported me in my recovery, the university that I feel very strongly connected to, and within the therapeutic recreation, well, the Department of Recreation and Leisure Studies, but in the therapeutic recreation program, so that I can help practitioners discover the other side of rec therapy. And I would really like to be a conduit between the university and the community. And if I could make up a position for myself right now, it would be to work 50% of the time in the mental health wing at the new hospital and 50% of the time at the university, and really have one foot on either side of the door so that what we discover through our work is put into practice without the 20-year delay between the publication of results and the community accessibility.
You'll be able to actually see your research being put into action.
Yeah.
And results from that.
Absolutely. I mean, there are some issues that surround that. I have to have been able to prove that my results are worthwhile to implementing. I don't want to be out there doing harm in any way, but I think that the premise of my results and the premise of my story being a strengths-based lens and trying to teach people that if we spend our whole lives trying to fix the problem, we're already beat before we've start. But if we look at what we're good at, if we look at how we can use our strengths to empower ourselves, the things that we're not so good at, they're not so hard to deal with.
Lauren, you are an inspiration, and I thank you so much for coming in this morning. I wish you all the best. I think I speak for everyone who's listening this morning. Everyone is proud of what you've done and what you're going to do in the future. Best of luck.
Thank you very much.
That was Lauren Torok, a master's student in applied health sciences at Brock, who is studying how recreation and leisure pursuits help people with mental illness live full and engaged lives. Years ago, the late great singer Pete Seeger sang, "Where have all the flowers gone?" Today, it might be better to ask, "Where have all the monarch butterflies gone?" According to an article in the Globe and Mail last month, the latest count of monarch butterflies overwintering in Mexico suggests the insect's North American migratory population has hit a new low and may even be at risk of disappearing altogether. How can this be? That familiar, beautiful monarch butterfly we grew up with no longer a part of our ecosystem? Is that what the future holds for us? To get some answers, I invited Brock University sustainability scientist and researcher Liette Vasseur into the studio recently to talk about what might be causing this problem and what, if anything, we can do to reverse the trend. I asked Professor Vasseur first if the monarch butterfly is the only migratory species at risk today.
There are others, in fact. Often people are looking at the monarch butterfly because it represents almost the canary in the mine, in terms of this is a species that is genuine, that we see and that can relate very well. However, we have many other species, especially birds, for example, and birds that are insectivorous, as well as some of the forest birds, singing birds, that are also in decline, and these are also migratory birds. Their migration is either towards the United States, Mexico, South America, Central America, or even Asia, and they also are, in many cases, suffering of a decline.
Is the problem the reason for the decline when they're here in our country, or is it because of where they're going to migrate?
In fact, it's more complicated than that. It's here, it's when they migrate, and also where they are going, depending on the different conditions.
I'm afraid to ask about the conditions. That's the obvious question. What's the problem here?
Yeah, well, there are several issues, and I should say that in many cases, we don't know exactly. As was mentioned a bit earlier this week for the monarch butterfly, we cannot pinpoint to only one problem. They're often a very confounded effect of several issues at the same time. In the case of here, for example, we can talk about habitat loss, urban construction, loss of forest, or loss of, in the case of monarch butterfly, grasses, weeds, especially milkweed that is not there anymore. These are causing certainly big issues. But there are also other issues, like, for example, application of pesticide. Because if you put a pesticide that is going to kill insects, monarch butterfly is an insect, so it's going to be attacked also by that. For birds, for example, insectivorous birds, for example, the fact that you use insecticide to reduce pest population in agricultural fields, for example, will decline also the number of insects and therefore the food for the birds. So that's another issue. But there are other components, for example, during the migration, and in fact there is a North American study that has just started this year, is looking at how many birds are hitting buildings, tall buildings, for example, during migration time. And it's the same for other type of, like the monarch, you know, hitting a truck or hitting a car. And unfortunately, that's something that's happening all the time. So this is during the migration. And when they get to their other field, their other component of their habitat, the wintering part, it's the same thing. Habitat loss is a problem. There may be pesticide application, another problem. There may be other type of disease that are coming that we are not aware, that are not necessarily here, but they may be there. So it's quite complex.
The pesticides we've been trying to make safer, whether we'll ever successfully make them safe for all wildlife and what have you, probably open to debate. We're doing better than we used to, but I would imagine as long as we've got pesticides around, we're always going to have that problem.
Yes, and that's for sure. And we say they are safer. It all depends. It's a relative term in some way. Safer for who and for what? In some cases, we think that we have safer pesticides, but we discover over the longer term that they are not as, like endosulfane, for example, which will be, is under phasing out for 2016. We're still using it, especially in PEI for potatoes. We know now that it has impact in the ocean, for example, on the coast. And now we're seeing some little doses that are remaining for a longer time. And they are as difficult to deal with than the pesticide itself.
So how big a problem is the climate change?
That's another factor. We are aware that especially on the migratory birds, there have been quite a lot of surveys done. And because we have the Christmas surveys, for example, and different other surveys that have been done over the longer term, and not only in North America, but also in Europe, that have shown that some birds are tend to come faster because the weather is getting better here over time in the spring. We have also some birds that used to migrate and are not migrating anymore. If we look at the American robin, for example, a big part is staying here. So we have several birds that are now capable of staying more in the region. And I should say, even with insect, for example, monarch butterfly is not the only insect that is migrating. I'm working, for example, on diamondback moth, which is a pest, unfortunately, in this case of mustard plants, and like canola, cabbage, broccoli, and etc. Usually, this species does not necessarily survive the winter here, but migrates between Florida, South Carolina, comes up in the spring, and will cause damage, and gradually migrate back to the southern part of the United States. And what we have seen a couple of years ago, for example, or even last year, the species has come a lot faster. So instead of having probably an arrival in June, they arrive in May, they arrive in April. We collected our first specimen, in fact, in April last spring. So we see that there's a faster move, if you want, of the species because of warmer temperature, for example.
You mentioned a pest, the moth. People aren't going to get up in arms, by and large, about a pest that they have no use for. Monarch butterfly, entirely different, because who doesn't love a monarch butterfly? Who didn't grow up admiring them? So maybe now people will start to sit up and take notice of the problem of the migratory species. They all play a part. It's like a giant jigsaw puzzle.
Yes, exactly. And that's the biggest challenge, is people don't understand that when we talk about the monarch, it's really one species. For us, it's really a kind of an emblem for the migratory species, but it's really the tip of the iceberg in some way. Protecting the monarch is in fact protecting a lot of other species, because you have, as I said, migratory birds, migratory insects, and in these cases, they all suffer relatively the same thing: habitat loss, pesticide application, pollution, hitting windows or cars or everything like that. These are all the same issues in all cases. How can we help? And this is something that we'll certainly continue to explore, is how can we really help to better protect these species, not only here in Canada, but in the States, for example, in Central or South America, where they are moving. And that's fairly complicated. So you can see that you need to not only look at the biology, but you need to look at society, you need to look at infrastructure, you need to understand legislation, because many of these are, especially for the birds, we have still the Migratory Bird Convention. So these are things that we have to consider at that point.
The real elephant in the room is the urbanization and encroaching on their natural habitat. I don't know how we can alleviate that problem outside of perhaps creating specific habitats for them. So how do we get around this problem?
Well, there are many ways, and I know that there are some initiatives, in fact, that have been taken in some places, even like, for example, on the waterfront trail. If you walk along Lake Ontario, there are places where people have put butterfly gardens, for example. So these are places that can help. Replanted milkweed, I saw a few homeowners who have planted milkweed to be able to help the species to come back. So there are ways. I know that even myself, I have a butterfly bush, and last summer, at one point, I had two monarchs on mine. So there are ways to try to help them. The question is, are we willing, each of us, to do a little step towards that? And it means for some people probably change a lifestyle, or it may be a very simple thing to do. You know, planting a couple of milkweed in your gardens is not going to be that difficult. However, do not use pesticide at the same time because you will kill them. So just be careful of what you're doing. It's just to be a little bit more mindful of what to do.
Now, that really brings it to the people saying, what can I do to help the situation? Planting milkweed, fairly simple operation, and yet you're doing not a huge thing, but you're doing a small thing that in the overall scheme of things does help the situation.
Yeah, exactly. And I would say that trying to think about what you're doing, most cities have put a ban on the fertilizer and pesticide. That was certainly a good step towards keeping the environment a little bit more sustainable for other species. But we still have a lot to do. And it's a question to see, but what can be done in a day-to-day life first to gradually see what are the larger initiatives that can be taken. And in some cases, people are thinking about it a lot more now, I think, than before. I'm hoping that by seeing the possibility of losing species, people are realizing that it's not only us, but it's the future generation, so their children and grandchildren will not be able to enjoy these species.
It's easier to save the species now while we've got them than it is to try to revive or bring them back once we've lost them in the future.
Yeah, exactly. And we have to think, how can we help even in other places? Like in Mexico, in many cases, why are they not keeping their habitat? But they need to survive too. And we have to be mindful of the fact that we may protect here, but if it's not protected there, it's not going to help too. So when we're looking at the number of hectares that they showed this year, how much it went down, it's quite impressive. But you have to realize that habitat loss is not only here, but it's there too.
It's everywhere.
Yeah.
No.
Exactly.
Okay, now, as far as pollution is concerned, some countries are doing more than others. And I think there might be a perception that one of the countries that might not be doing enough is China. Are they doing more than we think they are as far as controlling pollution that could help the situation here?
I would be careful about that because I work in China. And I was, in fact, with the United Nations Framework on Climate Change, the UNDP and UNEP last October in Beijing. And we were working with the Chinese Academy and all that. And interestingly enough, they are aware of the situation more than people think. And they are trying to do some efforts. The problem is, and this is a challenge that they don't know exactly how to deal with, is that their population, and especially their population consumptions, it's increasing faster than the application of pollution control that they are doing. So it's a question that it's almost like a double race in their case in terms of racing against time for reducing pollution, but also at the same time the race of increasing consumption for many people. So it's a societal debate that they have to have in China that is quite difficult. They are doing quite a lot of efforts. We have large projects right now on sustainable agriculture, for example, because they are trying to avoid using pesticide as much as possible in tea plantations, for example, in cauliflower, broccoli, rice, and other type of crops. So they're really strong push for these kind of things. They have large projects right now with several million dollars in trying to reduce, for example, soil erosion in northern China, where it's a big problem, especially towards the Mongolian plateau, by planting trees to try to reduce erosion, help a little bit more with evapotranspiration, etc. So they are doing quite a lot of efforts. The problem is the sheer number of people that you have to deal with is the issue by itself. So I know that it seems weird weird. But at the same time, you have to remember that China now is the leader in terms of solar panels. So they are doing very, very fast on some of these issues with new technologies. Many of their light poles there are all solar. So they don't have electricity going to most of their light poles, for example. It shows that they are trying. It's just a question to help with this challenge of having faster growth than you can do other things. That's the problem.
Urbanization in China, it's as big a problem there as it is here. They're trying to cope with the change, to manage the change, and as well preserve the environment at the same time. That's a delicate balancing act that they have to undertake there.
Yes. Oh, yeah, it is. And they are running out of land. That's the other issue. And at the same time, they have to feed their population. So you can see very well that they will start relying more and more on importation of food, because they will not be able to always sustain the productivity that they need. They are doing quite well right now for rice, wheat, and several other crops. But how long can that last? It will depend on how much encroachment of agricultural land by urban centers will occur.
What about other Latin American countries? Are they contributing to the problem, or are they making attempts as well to control the problems in their own countries?
There are many other countries that have huge problems. I was at the it was the Eco Summit. It's a large international conference on sustainability. And it was clear that with all the planned dams along the Amazon, for example, that it will have huge, large consequences, not only for the ecosystem of the Amazonia, but also globally, because we have to remember that this is one of our long of the world in terms of carbon sequestration, but also oxygen production. Some of the numbers and some of the people who were talking at that conference, for example, were mentioning that we're talking about a huge impact that could change the famous 2 degrees Celsius way more rapidly than we think.
As a sustainability scientist, are you optimistic we can overcome this problem in a reasonable amount of time?
As a friend of mine was saying a few weeks ago, you have to be optimistic. You have to try to find solutions. It's great to talk about the problems, but we have to start talking about solutions too. And I think this is why it's so important also to start educating our students about sustainability science. What does it mean? How can we find solutions? And solutions are coming often outside of the box. They are not necessarily the cutter type that we used to see. It's not coming from a box. And we have to use often more creativity, imagination. This is why you often need to not be in one discipline. You have to start talking with others, and you have to really break the barriers of disciplinary work. You cannot just be a biologist. You cannot just be an economist. You have to start talking to each other to be able to find new solutions.
Working with the students that you do at Brock, for example, are you finding that there is this great interest there, that we need to solve this problem and we need to start working on it now and get moving on this? Is there this groundswell of student interest at Brock for what you're trying to do?
Yes, there's quite a lot of interest. In fact, I find that students are realizing, especially when they start getting higher level courses, that they see the issues and they figure out, okay, we need probably to do something. So there's an eco club at the university. We're starting the master in sustainability science and society. These are places where they see, okay, I can probably do something. There's quite a lot of interest right now because they know that by finding tools and having the good knowledge to make it possible, they can start working in the society and help on these issues.
Professor Vasseur, we thank you very much for your time today. Thank you very much for taking time to come in and talk to us.
Oh, you're welcome.
That was Liette Vasseur, a sustainability scientist and researcher in biological sciences at Brock, on why monarch butterflies and other migratory species might be at risk of possible extinction if we don't take action now. That's it for this edition of Inquisitive Minds on CFPU-FM 103.7 in St. Catharines. My name is Mike Saunders, and I hope you've enjoyed the show. You can contact me via email at any time at talk@cfpu.ca with show comments and suggestions. Until next week, always remember to have an inquisitive mind. Thank you.